Welcome to the Supreme Court of Virginia podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Ben Glass Law and Virginia appellate attorney Steve Emmert. Listening to oral arguments from the Supreme Court of Virginia is one of the best ways to stay abreast of both substantive and procedural law. And today's smart lawyers know that any case, even if it is outside their practice area, can offer a learning opportunity. So, listen, enjoy, subscribe, and leave us feedback.
Much. Counsel, you may begin. I know this is a rather unusual experiment, but we will start the clock when you do begin. Do you have any time you wish to reserve?
Yes, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. We have that noted. You may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. My name is John Boitnot. I practice law in Rocky Mountain, Virginia. Today I represent Sandra Larson on appeal of a case that was decided in the Franklin County Circuit Court. Eric Larson was a magistrate here in Franklin County and well known to all members of the Franklin County Bar. He died testate. He was survived by his wife and his two children. In the fifth paragraph of his will, he devised his home and his farmland. He owned a house and a 100-acre farm. He devised that property to his children, subject to his wife having the right to reside in the home for so long as she is physically and mentally able to do so. There was obvious disagreement between the children and the wife as to the meaning of that language. Lawsuit was instituted and tried by the court. At trial, counsel agreed that parole evidence was not admissible, that the will provision was not an ambiguous provision. An argument then was made to the trial court prior to decision. The court found that Ms. Larson had the right to reside in the house and have the use of the remainder of the whole tract, subject to being terminated when she is no longer physically and mentally able to reside in the home. The remainderment, which is already determined by the will itself, is in the children. At trial, the parties agreed that the children had a vested remainder interest in the property. We had trouble getting a final order to the court, we being counsel for the parties. I was directed to draft the final order. A couple of attempts to get a final order entered were unsuccessful. Eventually, an order that was prepared by Mr. Ferguson was entered by the court, and it's that order that we contend has reversible errors in the order. That order was based in part upon the testimony of the drafter of the will, and based upon the testimony of the drafting attorney, the court included in its order a provision for Mrs. Larson's living in the home by herself, which was an additional in addition to the language in the will. So that we were disturbed by that. Also, the court entered in its order and said the right of Mrs. Larson to reside on the property was the children's rights in the 100-acre farm were limited only to the extent that they interfered with Ms. Larson's right. Those two things in the order constitute reversible error, in our opinion. The allowing the parole evidence to influence the judge's decision and include in the final order of constituted reversible error. We believe that the right to reside is a grant of an interest in the property that is measured by the duration of Mrs. Larson's lifetime. In effect, it is a life estate, but it is subject to conditions, limitations that Mr. Larson referred to in his will, for so long as is the limiting language, she is able to physically and mentally able to do so, which, so our position is that this language in the will, the unambiguous language in the will, creates a life estate in favor of Ms. Larson, conditioned or limited as expressed in the will, and only by the limitations in the will, not by herself, and not limited to the extent that they are the children. The children's interest is not the same as Larson's, and that they are a remainder interest that come behind Ms. Larson's interest, that they have no right until her interest is terminated under the language in the will. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you very much. Ms. Francois.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Vicki Francois, and I am counsel for the appellees, Pamela Larson Stack, and her brother, Kirk Larson, who are the adult children of the testator. The children ask this court today to uphold the ruling of the trial court in its entirety because the trial court did not err. Ms. Larson has three assignments of error, all regarding a tract of land that belonged to the children's deceased biological mother and father. And that land was first acquired in 1972, well before Ms. Larson came into the picture. But before I begin argument, I want to make two salient points. First, the children reiterate that they do not wish to oust Ms. Larson from the property where she currently resides. This very statement is contained in the joint appendix at page 36, and it remains true today. Purpose of this proceeding is to try to ascertain exactly what rights Ms. Larson has in the property. Second, Ms. Larson was not going to be without a home or a place to live. At the time of the testator's death, which coincidentally happens to be exactly 3 years ago today, this very day, April 14th, 2017, Ms. Larson was devised two separate properties in which she could live. The first property was an unencumbered true life estate in a home in Roanoke, as noted in paragraph 6 of the will. This was a life estate, and Ms. Larson was subject to no limitations to live there until her death. The second property, being the instant property at issue, which is not a life estate, but a mere right to reside, and is subject to limitations. Moreover, pursuant to the party's 2007 premarital agreement, Ms. Larson also already had a true and unfettered life estate in real property in Rocky Mount. As for argument, I will address the assignments of error in the order presented by Ms. Larson. The first assignment of error by Ms. Larson is without merit. The first assignment of error states that the trial court erred in holding that Ms. Larson did not have a life estate or a life estate subject to. And there are two main principles of law at play here. And I'm going to cite Justice McCullough in his ruling of Allison versus Brown. The issues in a case are made by the pleadings, not the testimony of witnesses or other evidence. And number two, The goal in the construction of a will is to discern the testator's intent. That is the cardinal rule for guidance to the court. So let's turn to the pleadings in this case. The complaint by the children says this is not a life estate. But more importantly, the answer also expressly admits that it was not a life estate. And that answer goes one step further and says it was never intended to be a life estate. That unredacted, unaltered answer is now the law of the case. Ms. Larson comes and says it's a life estate by implication, not the express language. She says that in her trial memorandum, JA page 13, and again in argument, JA page 46 and JA page 86. If the court were to adopt that position, that it's a life estate by implication, that is contrary to her answer in paragraph 4, where she says it is not a life estate and it was never intended to be a life estate. So for that reason, the trial court was correct. The issue as to whether or not a life estate existed was not ambiguous, and the court did not need parole evidence as to that issue.
Thank you for tuning in to the Supreme Court of Virginia podcast. My name is Ben Glass, and Steve Emmert and I provide these oral argument audios for free as a public service. If you're a fan of the podcast, I'd love to send you my book, Renegade Lawyer Marketing, absolutely free. Just visit www.benglassreferrals.com and I'll be glad to ship it to you. This book has helped thousands of lawyers across the country improve their lives and their practices. Again, that's benglassreferrals.com. Thank you for listening and enjoy these oral arguments from the Supreme Court of Virginia.
As to the remaining issues in the case, parole evidence was proper. There were many ambiguities in this will. As we've stated, first and foremost, the parties couldn't even agree if this was a life estate. Ms. Larson began by saying it wasn't, and then she adopted a contrary position in her trial memorandum and says it was. That in and of itself proves that there is an ambiguity in this case. But moreover, the parties were unable to decide what her right to reside in the home meant. There was much argument on the record. Did her right to reside in the home, was it limited to the marital house only, or was it all 101 acres? The word reside itself was ambiguous. Did it mean that Ms. Larson simply had a right to dwell or inhabit the property? Or was it a right to dwell without interference and free of control by others? Paragraph 5 of the will simply does not say that. Again, the parties still cannot agree. Must Ms. Larson live there alone? Or may others reside with her? And if others may reside with her, is it for the purposes of medical treatment so that she can continue to live there and be physically and mentally able to do so? The parties also discussed if she had the ability to sell crops or rent land. And lastly, at the conclusion of argument, the parties were still unsure as to who was to be paying the taxes. And counsel for Ms. Larson at that point in time said, if that's not clear who's to pay the taxes, then we will make it clear as to who's to pay the taxes and the insurance. And that was stated at Joint Appendix, page 121. Counsel for the children have always stated that this was unclear. And counsel for the children acquiesced to the testimony proffered by Mr. Brown. The children stated, Joint Appendix, page 80, to the extent the court found that the will was ambiguous in its parameters, Mr. Brown just testified and clarified that and told you what Mr. Larson intended. And again, that's the cardinal rule. If a will is not apparent, the plain language of the will is not clear on its face, the court must discern what the intent was. And that's exactly what the court did in this case. In fact, the court stated, Joint Appendix page 58, the court said it needs to hear from Mr. Brown. It didn't use precatory language saying it wanted to hear from Mr. Brown or it could hear from Mr. Brown. It said the court needed to hear from Mr. Brown. And then the court went on to elaborate on Joint Appendix page 67 that Mr. Brown should testify as to what the testator meant in paragraphs 5 and 6, or at least in paragraph 5. And the parties, again, acquiesced in that. Both parties were involved in the examination and the cross-examination of Mr. Brown. And Mr. Brown, his testimony basically splits the evidence. He gives one interpretation that arguably favors Ms. Larson by saying, I believe it was the testator's intent for her to have occupancy of the entire 101 acres, not just the marital home. But then he arguably gives one opinion that benefits the children, and that's found at page, Joint Appendix, page 69. Counsel for the children said, quote, do you know what he meant by physically and mentally? And that answer came in without objection. Mr. Brown stated that in the event she had to go into a nursing home or couldn't live there by herself anymore, that the property would dissolve and it would go to the children. And now, counsel for Ms. Larson, having elicited evidence that she does not like, has invited error to this court and asks that that opinion be deemed inappropriate. Parole evidence was proper in this case. Ms. Larson has previously stated to the court that parole evidence is proper when there's ambiguity. She noted that in her trial memorandum at page 11, where they cited Parsons versus Fitchett, that parole evidence is always admissible to aid in determining the true intent of the parties. And again, Ms. Larson indicated that parole evidence was proper at Joint Appendix, page 13, citing Edwards versus Bradley. The intention of the testator must be upheld if the will can be construed to effectuate such an intent that is not inconsistent with a rule of law. Parole evidence is proper due to the ambiguity. So what the court did is it took evidence, and the court followed the evidence in its entirety. It adopted the positions of Mr. Brown fully. At the end of the day, there was no error because both parties had a fair trial on the merits, and substantial justice was reached. Ms. Larson elected to not call any witnesses. That's found in the record, Joint Appendix, page 72. But what's also interesting to note is that the parties had even discussed reopening the case and taking further testimony of Mr. Brown. So there was a possibility, if either party was dissatisfied with the prior hearing, to reopen it. That fact is noted at Joint Appendix, page 112. Lastly, counsel for Ms. Larson had indicated that...
Ms. Francois, you have 3 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Larson knowingly elected to not ask Mr. Brown additional questions. and that is found in Joint Appendix, page 111 and 112. Your Honor, the goal of this case, in the goal of the testator, was to always have the property go to the children. That intent would be defeated if the court finds that Ms. Larson's interest is in fact a life estate, because that could be forfeited to Medicaid in the event she has to go to a nursing home. That is clearly contrary to the intent of this document. In conclusion, the will was not ambiguous, and that the plain language used in paragraph 5 did not create a life estate, nor was it intended to create a life estate pursuant to the answer of Ms. Larson. However, the will was ambiguous as to the rights and the parameters of the rights that Ms. Larson was otherwise conferred in paragraph 5. And as such, the uncontradicted evidence of the testator's intent, as stated by Mr. Brown, is proper, and the trial court's ruling should be affirmed in its entirety. It was my honor to make this argument on behalf of the children today, and we sincerely thank the court for its time.
All right, thank you very much for your argument. Mr. Voitnot, you have quite a bit of time that you reserved. You have 9 minutes and 52 seconds. You may begin now.
Your Honor, if there are no questions, I have nothing further to add. I appreciate your consideration this morning. We believe that the trial court committed reversible error, and we ask you to so find.
All right. Thank you very much. The clerk will call the next case.
Would you hire an appellate lawyer to handle your jury trial? Of course not. Trying cases requires a different focus, a different way of speaking, even a different way of thinking from handling appeals. So why would you ask a trial lawyer to handle your appeal? When it comes time to appear in an appellate court, trust a lawyer who specializes in appeals only. Steve Emmert limits his practice to appeals. Other lawyers consult him when they face tough problems in the appellate maze. Focus on what you do best. Call Steve Emmert at 757-965-5021 direct to find out how he can help you. Again, that's Steve Emmert at 757-965-5021.